a little bit tonight from what I usually do on these lectures, because I have just read a book that is positively intriguing and gives such practical, down-to-earth suggestions and seems to have such a logical thesis that I'd like to share it with you, and it's new enough, so I'm taking the chance that none of you have read it. And even if you have, you might enjoy the discussion about it. It's called Children the Challenge by Rudolf Dreikers. Dreikers brings out the point that we now are living in a democratic society. I was brought up in the autocratic age when father was boss. Mother did what father said, and the children had to do what mother and father said. But things have changed. Women have proclaimed their equality in the first place with men, and as the husband has lost power over the wife, both parents have lost power over their children. Now, children sense this equality with adults and no longer tolerate autocratic, dominantly submissive relationships. Parents too vaguely realize that their children have become their equals and have lessened the pressure of the you do as I say form of child raising. At the same time, they lack new methods based on democratic principles with which to guide and educate their children into democratic social living. Freedom is a part of democracy, but often freedom is mistaken for license. And I think we see the results of this in the grocery stores, for instance, where the kids just run wild and the mother thinks, well, what shall I do about it? And they don't do anything about it. And they vaguely realize that their children have become their equals. They've lessened their pressure, but at the same time, they haven't given the children boundaries. They haven't taught them that freedom also entails responsibility. We can't have freedom unless we respect the freedom of others. We must have order, and order bears with it certain restrictions and certain obligations. Now, our children can no longer be forced into compliance. They must be stimulated and encouraged into voluntarily taking their part in the maintenance of order. So we need new principles of child raising to replace the old obsolete traditions, which seem so simple. Just mind, period. But no longer. We have to think up. We have to really use our minds to be intelligent parents, or the children will simply outwit us. And most of them seem to these days. But parents are gradually becoming aware of the necessity to educate themselves on methods of child raising. For instance, Gannat's book, Between Parent and Child, has been on the bestseller list. Well, I think it's getting close to 2 years now. It's in paperback, can be bought for less than $2. And if you don't have it, I highly recommend it, because Gannat has some real practical, fun ways of dealing with children. He's a Jewish bachelor. But if any of you have seen him over TV, they've had him on time and again on the Today Show. And he has such a marvelous insight into the child's mind. And the book itself is just a delight to read. I think any of you would enjoy reading it. and we need all the ideas we can get. First of all, it's so important that we understand the child. So we need some pointers on child development. What can we expect of a child? Why does a child behave as he does? Unless we are aware of what is back of the child's behavior, we have little chance to change it. We can only induce him to behave differently by changing his motivation. Sometimes we can discover the purpose of his behavior by examining the results he obtained. If he knew he would no longer get results, what would be the sense of doing it? If his good behavior brought a warm smile and a pleased hug and a word of praise, he'd be less inclined to try to get attention through disturbing behavior. First of all, he desires to belong, and he'll repeat any behavior that gives him a sense of having a place and abandon that which makes him feel left out. Now, children are expert observers. If parents use anger in gaining power, they'll do the same. If baby gets all the attention, then acting like a baby might help. Now, if he meets difficulties in his child's environment, he either gives up or he compensates. Now, the relationship between the parents sets a pattern for all the relationships in the family. If mother and father cooperate, cooperation becomes the family standard. If mother and father love each other and they show their love for each other, then the child never has to worry about their love for him. Love just becomes part of the family relationship, and the child feels secure in that love. But then as soon as mother and father start bickering, then the child's feeling of security is shaken, and he doesn't know just where he stands. Should he stand with mother or should he stand with father? And he's just torn apart. But if mother and father show a solid front, and many a times it means that you have to put on an act, yet it's worth it. You can settle your differences outside of the earshot of the child. A lot depends on where the child comes in the family too. Depends on the family constellation. What role does a particular child play? As many parents say, well, I can't understand. Our oldest child is so independent, and we have no trouble with him at all. And here comes the middle one who has to show off all the time, and we don't seem to have any control of him. And the baby, of course, is still a baby. Well, here's the problem. You see, the middle child is the sandwich, and he has no distinction in the constellation of the family as he can see it. He's not the oldest, he's not the youngest, so he has to do something to gain attention. He has to find his place, and he has to feel an important part of the family circle. So he shows off, so people will look at him. A child behaves as he sees his situation in the family. He can be a good little boy, or he can be a stinker. And usually he gets labeled, and this hurts. I have seen mothers whose children are just mere babies, and they think he can't understand, but he can. Will sit and talk about how terrible that child is and how she just can't handle him while the child's sitting there listening. So she's labeling the child. The child starts gaining a self-image, and he's going to play it to the hilt. His role is being established by those people around him. He thinks of himself in terms that other people around him think of him, and he feels duty-bound to act in that role. A child will try anything. And if it works, if it fits its goal, he'll keep on doing it in order to find his personal identity. If he receives no satisfaction from it, he'll quit. So our problem is to devise ways in which the child receives satisfaction for behavior we consider acceptable and does not receive satisfaction for his misbehavior. We don't hope to have a perfect child any more than we expect to be perfect parents. I think it would be very dull to be perfect in any respect. But we can only expect improvement, and it's just our duty to try. And the most important thing in considering child raising and the needs of the child is to remember how important it is to encourage a child. It's, according to Dreikers, it's the most important aspect of child raising. The lack of it is the basic cause of misbehavior. A misbehaving child is a discouraged child. And our love for that child can best be demonstrated through encouragement toward independence. And as I heard Virginia Wythe say the other day, that the best thing we can do for a child is from the time he is born, try to raise him so that he can become independent of us just as quickly as possible. One thing at a time, of course. As a child is able to do for himself, let him do that thing. And encourage him. If he doesn't do a good job, just say, good try. And don't stand over him and criticize that this little thing wasn't right and that little thing wasn't right. You know what it does to yourself when you're criticized in this way. Well, think how much more devastating it is for a child to be criticized when he's not quite up to it. And we're so apt to say, oh, you're too little. You can't do that. You're too small. You'll probably spill it. Oh, that's the way it always happens. Now, these things pour out, and we don't realize what we're doing to that child. We're just crushing his courage. We're discouraging him. We so often reject our children as being weak or inferior. Courage is found if one who can make a mistake and fail without feeling lowered in his self-esteem. They need the courage to be imperfect. They need to know that we goof too once in a while. And I think we would do our children a lot of good if when we do goof, we would admit it. Because then they're going to admit goofing too. And they're going to realize that that's not so bad, not to be so perfect all the time. But it will still give them courage to try the next thing. And yet, we have to be careful about our using praise insincerely. You know, we can gush a little too much and the child realizes that, oh, she just said that. And realizes that we're not sincere. Well, now that kind of praise can be almost as damaging as discouragement. But instead of being gushy about our praise, if we could just use simple comments about it, matter-of-fact comments like, my, I'm glad you can do that. Or how nice. Or I really appreciate what you did. Or, see, I knew you could do it. And that's all that's necessary. And again, and then too, children don't need bribes to be good. They don't want to be good. Good behavior springs from their basic desire to belong and to be approved of and to contribute usefully and to cooperate. Now, when we bribe him for good behavior, we're in effect showing him that we don't trust him. which was really a form of discouragement. Now, a reward does not give a child a sense of belonging. Satisfaction comes from a sense of contribution and a sense of participation. A sense actually denied to our children in our present system of rewarding them for material things. It's our mistaken efforts to win cooperation through reward. We are actually denying our children the basic satisfaction of living. And they're almost as bad as punishment. Now, as far as punishment is concerned, Dreyfus, and I heartily agree with him, says that it's better to use the natural and logical consequences. Now, do we have the courage enough to let the child suffer natural consequences? Or are we going to rush in there and protect him? He's not going to grow if we do. We're going to cringe a lot of times. For instance, if he runs off and forgets his lunch, are we going to dash over there with his lunch money? Or are we going to let him go hungry that day so that maybe the next day he'll remember his lunch? And when we do this, we must not moralize. We must not say, if you'd remembered your lunch, you wouldn't have had to go without lunch. It's your own fault. Then we're just erasing the good of helping him grow that can be done if the child, without our entering into it, it isn't our affair. Let's act as though we're a disinterested party, really. But that this is his affair. Just leave the monkey on his back. When we rush in to take the child's part, then he can always dump everything on Papa and Mama instead of assuming the responsibility himself. Let him have an alarm clock in the morning to wake him. And let him ignore the alarm clock and miss school. Let him take the consequences. Do we have the courage to do this, Dreyfus says. There can be some argument on that. Now, for instance, it's the same thing when it comes to eating. Now, eating is our individual problem. It's their individual problem. That's his body. Let him take care of it. The food is there. If he wants it, he'll eat it. If he doesn't eat it, let's make sure he does not get anything until the next meal. Let him take the consequences. The reason children don't eat at the table is because they want attention. And if they get that attention, they're going to continue not to eat. And if we sit and shove the food into them after they're old enough to feed themselves, boy, that's great. They're getting all that attention, undivided attention from Mama or Papa, whoever it happens to be. And reminding them that they'll be hungry if they don't eat is the same as punishment. Just keep still about it. Let them take the consequences without our pointing this out. Because the minute we point out, if you don't eat, you'll be hungry, then we're taking the responsibility away from him, you see. It's up to him. He knows that if he doesn't eat, he'll be hungry. Let him find it out if he doesn't know it. But that's his affair, not ours. We're so willing to step in and live our child's life in spots where he needs to live it himself and learn these things. This is what we call growing in inner discipline. If logical consequences are used as a threat, and say, you know, you'll be hungry if you don't eat, or imposed in anger, they cease to be consequences and they're punishment. They become punishment then. Now, children respond to logical consequences when the parent has a sense to shut up. But they fight back when they're punished. They'll start arguing with you if you start talking to them about better eat it or you'll be hungry. But don't give them a chance to argue. And be firm without dominating. Firmness is our refusal to give in to undue demands of the child or to indulge his every whim. If we don't want him to have it, we say no, and that's it. And we don't have to say no anymore. Just keep still. Give him the old silent treatment. Don't argue with him. You've said no, that's it. We don't say no again. We just keep still. We retreat into silence. And the child gets no results from his whimpering. He doesn't even get undue attention from it. He's ignored. He can scream and holler and yell. And if we have to retreat to the bathroom, retreat to the bathroom to get away from it if it gets on your nerves too much, because that's a private place and they won't come pounding on the door, so they're not so apt to come and intrude there as they might someplace else. But just retreat. Now, if we know these things before the child has become spoiled, then we save ourselves so much trouble, because he learns it as he's ready to learn it. That's why it's so important that preschool parents learn the technique before the child gets into all these bad habits, and we get into all these bad habits. Now, Dracher emphasizes the fact that we must show respect for the child. Democratic living is based on mutual respect. Humiliating a child for any reason shows intense lack of respect, and is certainly not a training device. Respect for the child means that we regard him as a human with the same rights to make decisions as we have. And we must help the child to show some respect for order. A child has no respect for order if he's shielded from the results of disorder. So if we're going to just keep picking up after him all the time, we can just keep picking up after him all the time. I love to listen to a child psychologist in Oklahoma City. I knew what he was going to say in mostly, but I love to hear him say it. And because this question always came up, what are we going to do about messy rooms? My child won't clean up his room. He just simply says, shut the door. Now, Dracher offers this suggestion that maybe once a week we go in with the child and help him clean, and not in an angry way, and not talking all the time, what a mess, what a mess. Oh dear, I don't see why you can't, you know, yakety yakety yes, the whole time we're helping him. But go in there with a good feeling and have fun with him in getting the room slicked up, and maybe getting some drawer dividers. And said, you know, it might be easier to keep your underwear straight in these drawers if we put some little dividers. Would you like to have dividers or maybe a little box? Get him in on the act, trying to work with him in devising ways that it might be easier to keep his room neat. I know I went through this, like I say, I went to hear this psychologist all the time, because this was my big problem. How can I get my girls to keep their room neat? And I finally, in order to get them to make their bed in the easiest possible way, I bought these blanket covers. And I put all the blankets inside the cover, the washable cover. It was a little cotton seersucker, so that they had only one piece to spread over the top of the bed. They didn't even have a separate sheet, because we washed it each week just like a sheet, that cover. And we had the nice fitting contour bottom sheet, so really there was just no excuse at all for them not just to pull that whole business up. And the bed was made, and it worked, because they knew I was trying so hard in every way to help them, to cooperate with them in making it easier for them to get their bed made each morning without it taking a lot of time. And this is the problem with children. They're just too busy. They're just too busy to keep things neat. And some somehow he kind of likes children who are always busy. They're the happiest kind, but sometimes they drive us to distraction with their messiness, because the busy ones are the ones with all the projects. And I remember I came into my daughter's room once, and she had encyclopedias opened up this way, all over the floor, just all on the places that she had looked up, you know. And it was all over the floor. But, you know, a mother can't gripe at a child for doing something like this. This amount of messiness is certainly to be tolerated. But the important thing is that the mother doesn't take over the responsibility for the order in that child's room. And then we must respect the rights of others. And he gave a rather interesting solution here. He said, you know, have you seen children slap their mother? I have. I never experienced this myself with my own children, so I don't know how I would have handled it had they done this. But I have seen children slap their mother. Well, he suggests just play it, pretend it's a slapping game and be happy about it, so just slapping back. Oh, you're going to play a slapping game. Well, good. You know, and just hit him back. And he said, don't just give him a little tap. Make it hurt. And the child will get over the slapping game in a hurry. But don't do it in anger. Don't turn around and say, okay, if you're going to slap me, I'm just going to slap you. And, well, it becomes a power struggle. And this we must avoid in a democracy, the struggle for power. We've got to be on the same side, regardless. And the minute we lose our cool, we're sunk. Then the power struggle begins. Now, he also suggests that we eliminate criticism and minimize mistakes. When we pay constant attention to the mistakes, we discourage a child. We take away his courage to try. We can't build on weakness. We have to build on strength. Center your attention upon what the children can do well and express confidence in their abilities. Give them encouragement. Mistakes and faults may die with lack of feeding, says Dreikers. Separate the deed from the doer. Don't say, for instance, well, you didn't do a very good job, because that makes him feel guilty. You connect the deed with the doer there, but rather, you tried, or it was a good try, is much better to say. Then you're non-committal. You don't have to judge the child. Avoid judging the child at all costs. He will judge the product himself. Maintain a routine. No child is ever too young to experience order. Once this has been established, children sense it and will know what to do as a matter of course. When it comes to going to bed, do it at the same time all the time, and it's just a matter of course. Now, of course, summer routine will probably vary from winter routine. You let them go to bed later. You let them get up later. But let it be a routine. Then the child feels a security in knowing what is going to happen. And, of course, it's the mother who has to establish these standards. And if they have jobs, have these jobs, have the children decide when these jobs should be done, and then encourage them to stick with this routine. Not gripe at them about it, but let them know when the job should be done, so they know what is expected. They know their boundaries. And children, sometimes we just take for granted that children ought to know how to do certain things. He ought to know how to take off his clothes and put on his clothes, put on his socks. Take time to help him do it when you see that he's ready, so that he can do it without too much of a struggle. Same way with teaching him how to wash himself. Talk to him about the right way of washing. Don't just assume he's going to know. Same way with brushing teeth. explain the process, and then the child will know. And same way with thought, crossing the street. All these things that have to be talked about, and a real training time set aside for these things. And don't try to train him to do something that he's not ready for. When a child is ready for a task, he can learn it with joy. Otherwise, it becomes painful, and learning no longer is a joy. If we expect him to do things he's not ready for. But by giving him the thing he's ready for, the developmental task at the right time, then he can really experience deep satisfaction in being successful. And success can become a habit. It's a wonderful habit for a child to feel that he can do it, and he can do it well. This is the wonderful thing, I think, about nursery schools and pre-kindergarten. Here the children, the people, at least, I wouldn't put my child into a school of this kind unless you're sure that the director and the teacher does have full knowledge of what the developmental task is and what it means to direct the child in the thing that he's ready to learn. But here he can experience success. And all you need to do is to step into a nursery school to realize whether or not it's a good one. If everybody's happy in doing a job that he can do well, and there's a spirit of joy instead of frustration, then you can be pretty sure that it might be a pretty good place for your child to be. Prepare your child for new experiences. For instance, if he has to go to the hospital, or if he's going to the dentist, or to the doctor, do a little role-playing with him so that it won't all be new, and so that he won't become frightened at it. But make it a game and play it through so that he knows the things that he will experience in this trip. In our thinking about training our children, let's make sure we don't do it in front of guests or in public. Have you seen parents taking on the training process when the guests come, or when they're downtown someplace? It just isn't the time to train the child. The child should be trained before this so that he knows what is expected of him. And it's easy to win the cooperation of a child. In former times, when authority was invested in those who were in control, cooperation meant just doing what you were told. The inferior was required to cooperate with his superior. Democracy brings a new meaning to this word. We must work together to meet the demands of the situation. While we have greater equality and greater freedom in the democratic atmosphere, we also have greater responsibility. Having lost our status, our superior, the power of superior status, we need techniques to stimulate cooperation. Now, politeness alone can go a long way toward cooperation from children. We can phrase our request to indicate that we understand the child's point of view. "I'm sorry to interrupt you," we can say. And many times it's not what we say, but it's the way we say it to the child that makes the difference. We've got to keep out of that power struggle. I think one reason children in the nursery school, for instance, cooperate so beautifully is simply because they're treated as people. They're not talked at, but we speak with the children, and we respect every child as being a very worthy individual worthy in his own right, not because of what he can do or because of the skills, his skills, but rather because he is himself. Avoid giving undue attention to a child. The child who keeps demanding constant attention from adults is an unhappy child. For instance, the child who, when the mother has a guest, is always running in, always interrupting. Or when the mother is on the telephone, always at her, always at her. Well, he's receiving some kind of satisfaction from this. And apparently the mother is giving that satisfaction. Now just figure out how can you take away the satisfaction he's receiving from this constant interruption. Dressers advises the mother to ignore the child. Just say firmly what she expects of the child, and then from that time on, keep still. No more power struggle, just no more talking. This is it. And give them the silent treatment. Parents who try to assert themselves, parents attempt to assert themselves, and then the children declare war. The time we order a child to do something or try to make him do it, we invite the power struggle. This does not mean that we can't guide or influence our children into proper behavior. It only means that we must find a different and effective approach. We must abandon the obsolete, futile attitudes and methods and assume those which will be effective. When something must be done and the child refuses, for instance, if you take the child to the doctor, he's got to go to the doctor. And he refuses to get out of the car, you just pick him up and carry him in to the doctor. And that's it. We don't talk about it. We don't say, you've got to get out. Now stop being such a bad boy. And come on now, quit your crying. Just don't say a word. Just carry him in. Things that have to be done have to be done. We must learn how to lead and how to stimulate. Whenever we approach a child with a determination to make him do something, he senses it and he starts to rebel. Our prestige takes the greatest beating when our children defy us. We must concern ourselves with what the situation needs and forget about the assault upon our dignity. If we're going to think about the assault on our dignity, we're just going to try to get even with that child and force him, you see, and here is a power struggle. Most important is to be firm about what I'm going to do, not about what I'm going to make the child do. Understanding, encouragement, logical consequences, mutual respect, respect for order, routine, and winning cooperation, all of these come into play as a means of resolving the power struggle. Of course, when a power struggle has already evolved, the use of logical consequences is usually impossible. The best structured consequence then degenerates into punishment because the parent is using it as a weapon on his side of the contest. The parent must use his ingenuity, his tact, and his sense of humor to promote willingness. And I put a big underline under sense of humor. I think this is the saving grace of parenthood. If we can just learn to laugh with our children and make things joyful instead of a contest. And the more he realizes he's irking us, the more fun it is. He's getting some real satisfaction out of this, you know. I know there's a little boy, a four-year-old, in Oklahoma, in Rock Island, who kept saying damn all the time. Of course, he's always getting reaction from his parents. Oh, no, that's such a bad word, you know. And so, of course, he'd say damn. And finally, his parents tried everything. He really had them going. And they said, okay. They gave him the final ultimatum. If you say damn once more, you're just going to have to go live someplace else because people in this house don't say damn. So he put his pajamas in a suitcase. He had a little overnight case. And they said goodbye. They were wondering how far he would go. And he went down the road a little ways. They lived in a rural area, and he kept going slower and slower and slower, and pretty soon he stopped. He came back with his suitcase. He went up to the door and rang the bell. His dad answered the door, and he says, you know, Dad, I can't think of a damn place to go. Who won that battle? Whenever the child succeeds in getting us into a conflict, let's withdraw from it just as fast as we can. It's not necessary, for instance, going to bed. I'm going to read his little illustration here because I'm afraid I'll forget a detail. This going to bed thing seems to be a bugaboo with so many parents. Every evening at 7:30, the battle of bedtime started. Four-year-old Harry was a master in prolonging the battle. Come here, it's time for bed, Mother would say quietly. Not yet, Mother, I'm not sleepy. But it's your bedtime, Mother persuaded. After a while, when I finished coloring my picture, the boy argued, you come right now. Mother said harshly. You can finish your coloring tomorrow. As Mother tried to put things away, Harry screamed and gathered his friends within the curve of his arm in an effort to prevent them from being picked up. Mother, hesitating to fight bodily, yielded. Well, all right then, finish the picture. Harry again concentrated on the book, a tiny smile at the corner of his mouth, and Mother sat down on the bed to wait. The child's crayon moved more slowly and more slowly, and Mother became impatient. You're just fooling around. Come on now, finish it. I want it to be real pretty. I have to be very careful, was the boy's smug reply. Mother waited impatiently a while longer and then said that she would put away the crayons that were no longer needed. Harry protested. Mother insisted. Harry reluctantly let Mother put some of the crayons away, teasing her all the time by holding back or pretending to lose some. Once things were put away, Harry found many more ways to delay bedtime. He dawdled in his bath, romped on the bed, wanted a drink of water, and finally Mother got him tucked in and returned to the living room. A few minutes later, her son was up again to go to the bathroom, then wanted another good night kiss. At 9 o'clock, he was still active. Mother lost her temper and whacked him. Harry burst into screams. Daddy came to the door and scolded Mother. I don't see why you have to have all this ruckus every night. Harry, shut up. Get in that bed and stay there. Well, finally there was peace. Now, there are several ways to solve the problem. One is to withdraw from the conflict. Perhaps Mother and Daddy could reach an agreement as to what to do. Let's see how that could work. During the afternoon play hour, Mother says to Harry, 8 o'clock is your bedtime. I'll tell you when it's time for your bath. Daddy and I will tell you goodnight at 8 o'clock. After that, we will no longer be concerned with what you do. At 7:30, Mother starts Harry's bath water and calls him. I want to play some more, the boy answers defiantly. Your bath water is ready, dear, Mother answers and returns to the living room. At 8 o'clock, Mother and Daddy go to Harry's room. Harry's still playing. Good night, my boy. Daddy picks his son up and gives him a hug. I'll see you in the morning. Good night, darling. Have pleasant dreams. And Mother kisses him. The parents return to the living room and turn on the television. But I haven't had my bath, Harry yells, running into the living room. Mother and Daddy act as if Harry were already asleep. Harry climbs into Mother's lap. I want my bath, Mother, Harry whimpers as he puts his face in front of Mother's. George, let's make some popcorn. This Ruth gets rid of the lap to sit on so she can get up, and Mother gets up, allowing Harry to slide off her lap, and Harry does everything he can think of to get attention. He screams, he stomps, he stands on his head, drags him on his parents' legs. Nothing avails. Finally, he goes to his room and undresses. Next, he comes out and asks to have his sleepers fastened. Mother and Daddy are absorbed in television and act as if he were already in bed and sound asleep. About 9:30, Harry climbs into bed unassisted, with his sleepers unfastened, and cries himself to sleep. Mother and Daddy have been firm. They have said good night and then been responsible only for what they would do. They have withdrawn and left Harry the field. He desperately redoubles his efforts to engage them in fighting, to get him to go to bed. He even plays on their pity by crying. Still, their firmness holds. A new way of training has begun that fundamentally alters the boy's relationship to his parents and to order. The following night, Harry could be ready for his bath, and Mother and Harry would enjoy the half hour together. At 8 o'clock, Mother and Daddy would tuck Harry in, say goodnight, and leave him. Of course, this only happens if we've started wrong with our children. If we've started the thing right when the child was small, we wouldn't have to go through all this remedial training. Another chapter he calls Action, Not Words. You know, the same psychologist that I was talking about in Oklahoma City that I love to hear had a favorite story about children who were brought to him with problems. And he said that he usually asked them to draw a picture of either the mother or the father, whoever he felt might be the person who was causing the problem. And this one little boy drew a picture of his mother, and he faced her to the wall. And Dr. Sisney said, "Now, why did you face her to the wall?" He said, "If I had turned her around, it would have been yakety, yakety, yak." And I think this is one of our big problems. We mothers are forever yakking at our youngsters. For instance, wash your hands. You can't come to the table. And of course, they have to be told a million times to wash their hands. Well, let them come to the table with dirty hands, but just don't give them any food. Don't put any plates by their places. Just say you don't eat with people who have dirty hands, and everybody who has clean hands gets a plate and gets food. And that's it. Don't say anything. Just don't talk about it. Just act. And there will be no power struggle here. No words, no fighting, no people at different poles, but this is just a matter of fact. We eat with clean hands in this house, and that's it. People with dirty hands don't get food, period. If you can behave, you can go to the grocery store with me. But you have a choice. Either go to the store with me and behave, or don't go to the store with me. And another chapter made me curious. It was called Don't Shoo Flies. He said, we are inclined to brush aside disturbing behavior with don't. Stop that. No, no. Hurry up. All these little admonitions. Be quiet. Don't do this. Don't do that. And here again, yakety, yakety, yak. But if we give this little annoying thing, whatever they're doing, our full attention, instead of just, you know, kind of offhand saying, don't do that anymore, or, you know, and then just don't give him our, just kind of glance over there. This will do nothing. But if we go over to him and talk to him about this specific thing and exactly what you expect, for instance, he told about the mother who pushed her child in the tailor tot, and the child kept dragging her foot. Well, a mother told her to get her foot back on the tailor tot, and she would get it back up. But then pretty soon she'd be dragging it again. And it was, get your foot back up, get your foot back up, finally slapping the feet. And it was just kind of a nagging all the way along. But the child was getting, you know, the attention he wanted. And the doctor said, what that mother should do is the minute the child starts pulling the the foot to stop going. Just wait until the foot goes back up. But don't say anything. It's this talking that is the ruination of our association, our communication with our children. We're talking at them all the time. If we just take action and shut up, then we can get some results. But we never seem to know when to keep still. Now, he also says, use care in pleasing. Have the courage to say no. You know how often the child says, oh, please, just this once, mother. And if we go back and realize how many times we've given in, just this once. We have difficulty seeing the long-term results of yielding to the child's every whim, since pleasing the child brings temporary harmony to the home. Oh, we're giving. Oh, we'll let her have it. You know, that's so much easier than to hold out. What's the difference? Children need to learn how to manage frustrations. Toys should have a useful purpose or meet a given need. They should be given on days when presents are expected or seasonally. There is no limit to what he can demand. He assumes that the supply of money is limitless and his sense of value of material things becomes distorted. And I think traveling fathers have to learn that they don't have to have a present every time they come home. With the hands out, you know, what did you bring me, Daddy? Well, we bring that on ourselves, because every time Daddy comes home, he brings a present. And then sometimes, pretty soon they take it for granted. If it's just a special once in a while thing, then the child appreciates it. But if it's going to be every time, he's going to demand it every time. And here is where a child learns what gratitude means. And we can't be too concerned about giving our children a feeling of real gratitude. Gratitude is so closely connected with love. These demanding children have been made demanding by giving parents who are so anxious to win and to buy their child's affection.
I just have a question, because you were talking about this bit about going to the store.
Yeah.
And saying, if you behave, well, that's a bribe, in my estimation.
I didn't word it the way Dragford did, because that would be a very poor way of saying. But we go to the store and behave. I mean, this is going to the store is we expect them to behave. I mean, this is prior to the proposition. He has a choice. He can go to the store.
You tell him what you expect at the store before you go, so you don't have to.
That's right.
While you're there. And
that's right. We talk it over, give him a choice. Go to the store and behave, or stay at home. But going to the store means behaving.
Staying home means that the mother stays home too.
Well, this depends on what the circumstances are. Everybody has his own way of having to work it out, but by no means allow the child to go to the store with you if you can't depend on his behavior. I mean, even if it means waiting until the father comes home so he can stay with the child so you can go to the store. I mean, this should be a privilege to go to the store and a responsibility, and the child should see his responsibility to behave. I know all of you have seen just miserable mothers yakking and pulling at their kids, screaming at them at the top of their voice in the grocery store.
Yeah, but sometimes those people bring their kids out when it's nap time, and I get irritated at it.
I know.
Little kids that are like this in a shopping cart,
they would be crazy.
You know, 1:30, 2 o'clock in the
afternoon.
I actually
stopped a mother. I don't usually interfere. I've been tempted so many times, but I don't usually. But this mother was just beside herself with this child, and it was It was about 1:30, and he was nothing satisfied him. I mean, she had bought him all these things. He had this cart full of stuff, and he had a balloon, and he had a sucker, but he was still yakking. And I, as I went by the mother, I said, I'll bet it's nap time. And she looked at me, you know, I just knew that this was the problem, poor child. No, when there's a screaming child in a grocery store, there isn't, I don't blame the child, ever. He's doing it for a reason. And I think the mother had better find out what the reason is. Refrain from overprotection. Some mothers are so overprotective, I mean, they see danger lurking everywhere. Some mothers just like to keep their children helpless and dependent on them, because that makes them feel important and protective. The minute the child can get along without the mother, this takes something away from the mother who doesn't feel self-sufficient herself. And sort of places mother in the dominant position and keeps the children submissive. However, today's children don't tolerate such efforts. They rebel. We may doubt our ability to tackle our problems. Therefore, we have much less confidence in the ability of small children to take care of themselves. When we pamper and coddle our children and try to protect them from life, this is the gift we give them, a helpless fury against an outrageous world. We have the obligation to instruct our children in ways, means, and attitudes with which to cope with life. What can I do about it? We can stand ready to step in at the point at which the problem becomes too much for the child. We can start this procedure at the day of his birth, little by little. With care and guidance, we hand our child life and its problems, its challenges, and its satisfactions. I felt so sorry for a couple of children in a family I know where the mother was always afraid that the children were going to be hurt. And this went on even into adulthood. Well, when the boy was going out on a date, she'd say, "Well, I won't sleep awake until you get home. You go, you take the car, but, you know, I'm going to be home and be miserable the whole time." And she never could send her children out with, say, "Have fun. Enjoy yourself." I always thought if it ever came to the point where I felt I had to keep track of my children, what time they got in and what have you, and couldn't trust them, I think I would tell my daughter or my son, "Now, I'm not going to worry. You set the alarm clock. Let's decide on when you're coming in, and then you set my alarm clock at that time. In the meantime, I'll go to bed and I'll sleep soundly, but I won't start worrying until that alarm clock starts ringing. If you come in before the time, you come in and turn it off, so it won't go off, so it won't ring, and then I'll sleep soundly through the night." And by this means, you don't have to sit up. And I think there are some mothers who just have to worry. I mean, they're just made this way. But I think if we can set up little devices such as this so that we don't have to keep on worrying, the child will feel so much warmer toward us if we don't make the child feel guilty every time he takes the car or goes on a date. Now, I have filled up an hour of time. I'm not through, but I don't want to keep you here if any of you have to leave. I won't feel insulted if you have to go, but I'll continue if some of you are free to stay.
I like that. Make a couple of observations.
Yeah, I'd welcome them.
One thing I disagree with is the idea that parents shouldn't quarrel if our children are trying to hide it. Because child's expense, and I think that there's a fair amount of expense. the disagreements in front of the children, then to show love between the parents, but not try and hide the conflict, because that creates as many or more problems as you have in conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, I don't know, it's not so much the form of the family case. I think we're trying to get adjusted people. There's studies done now that it isn't so much the form that the family takes, whether it's authoritarian, democratic, matriarchal, patriarchal, what have you, but it's the relationship in which this is carried out, in the love relationship within the family.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is, why is it the mother that all are supposed to set up the rules?
Yeah.
Even so, why is it the mother to establish this?
Maybe we help the fact that so many fathers don't play their role because so many of us women play both of them. Yeah, I would love to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
technically, it's very difficult because men are way ahead. Many men feel very, I think, really feel badly that they aren't quite, doing their fatherly role, but they don't quite also know, aren't really getting their help.
Well, this business of child psychology, everyone has a new idea and a different idea, and I'm just presenting Dreiker's right now. You may not have come in when I started, but this is Children the Challenge by Dreiker's, and I haven't read a book yet a child psychology book where I agree wholeheartedly all down the line. I'm just presenting his ideas.
How do you spell that?
Dreikurs.